unable to stop drones from reaching their intended targets. A few days ago, three drones operated across northern Palestine, and the situation remains critical as over a million people enter shelters daily due to the ongoing threats.
The drones launched by Hezbollah and the missiles have certainly become a source of concern for the Israeli enemy and settlers, forcing them into shelters. However, the pressing question now is whether all of this will influence Netanyahu's decision to continue his war against Lebanon, given that the nightmare of the drones has become a reality.
All of this is certainly putting pressure on the psychological state of the settlers. After the Israelis experienced a significant period from September 17 to 27, they felt a surge of confidence, became inflated, with over 80% of settlers initially supporting a war with Lebanon. However, this support is now beginning to wane as losses increase and objectives remain unfulfilled. The settlers have also become targets themselves. They've also entered the game, facing daily attacks, not just in Kiryat Shmona or the settlements near the Lebanese and Palestinian borders, but in Haifa as well. Netanyahu is unlikely to back down soon, as he has a big goal in mind. Despite the high human and material costs for Israel, he aims to maintain his grip on power by deepening the crises in Gaza, Lebanon, Iraq, and Syria. His ambitions are grand, and he has stated multiple times that he seeks to reshape the West Asia. Just a few days ago, again, there were claims that they're changing the face of the West Asia, insisting that they're still in the heart of the battle and that it would be premature to call for a ceasefire or halt to hostilities. This perspective seems unrealistic, especially since they have not achieved their goals in Gaza over the past year. The Palestinian resistance today is stronger than in the early days also. The human losses that Israel is facing now are greater than those in the initial days of the war. Additionally, Israel is unable to bring an end to the situation in Gaza, let alone in Lebanon. The complexity of the issue is significant, and it also has American support, making it difficult to resolve easily unless the costs increase.
The recent activities of Hezbollah and the significant losses and damages they cause have become a major focus for the Israeli media. They are particularly interested in knowing more about the real capabilities of these operations, especially in light of Hezbollah Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qasem mentioned in his latest speech regarding the drone that targeted Netanyahu's home in Qaysariya. This has prompted Netanyahu to take extraordinary measures to protect himself from Hezbollah's drone operations. Mr. Tariq Aboud, how do you explain Israel's focus on Hezbollah's drones, which have successfully reached their intended locations, while Israeli airstrikes have so far failed to intercept them?
Of course, before the war, the Israelis were thinking too highly of their air defense systems, believing that their anti-aircraft warfare would fully protect the skies over the occupied Palestinian territories. They thought that Hezbollah and the resistance were unaware of this. However, in practice, the Israelis managed to intercept many missiles and rockets, but when it came to the drones, over 80% of them reached their targets and detonated. This is evident from incidents like the Gharia drone and the Benyamina military base attack, along with numerous operations launched from Lebanon targeting northern Israeli communities and deeper into the occupied territories. Additionally, just the other day, the Israelis introduced a new role for human surveillance, meaning they no longer relied solely on radar systems. Instead, they deployed soldiers in northern Palestine to see the drones with the naked eye to avoid the danger of these drones.
Mr. Tariq Aboud, as we followed in this report from the Hebrew media, Netanyahu is now living in hiding, fearing for his safety, especially after the drone that brought Hezbollah to the doorstep of his home in Qaysariya. What do you think about this situation and the psychological stress Netanyahu is currently experiencing?
This is a significant psychological issue. The Israeli citizens, particularly the settlers, have always believed that the Israeli army could protect them from any external aggression. For the past 50 to 70 years, the internal front has been relatively untouched by actual warfare, as conflicts have primarily occurred on foreign lands. This reflects Ben-Gurion's doctrine, which emphasizes a security approach focused on decisive action and battles on others' territories. Today, the Israeli settlers are also required to follow the internal front's directives, becoming a participant in the war. Meanwhile, the prime minister, hiding in shelters or concealed locations, wanting to present a strong front to the nation. But this has been postponed due to concerns about drone threats.
The question arises, is Netanyahu really going to cancel his son's wedding due to the Hezbollah demonstrations and the need for secrecy about his location? What does this entire situation reflect?
It reflects a noticeable concern regarding Israel's security situation, as the Israeli army seems unable to protect settlers. Meanwhile, the resistance forces and groups are capable of reaching various points, not just from Lebanon, but also from Iran, as seen in the events of April 13 and 14, and the attacks from Iraq targeting port of Haifa and port of Eilat. Additionally, missiles and drones from Yemen contribute to the overall picture. While Israel may achieve some tactical goals, strategically it appears to be losing ground, as the occupied Palestinian territories have become targets for multiple enemies who can access these areas. If it weren't for American presence and support from NATO allies, along with backing from some certain Arab nations, the situation regarding Iran and Yemeni missiles, as well as the developments on the northern front in Lebanon, would be entirely different.
Netanyahu appears to be quite fearful for his life today due to Hezbollah's drones. As a result, he is considering postponing his son's wedding out of concern that Hezbollah will head to the place with its drones. Additionally, he seems using this threat as a pretext to delay his court proceedings related to corruption charges, security for public figures within Israel. An Israeli expert, as reported in this Hebrew media piece, acknowledges Hezbollah's impressive ability to locate and accurately target Israeli officials. This admission raises significant concerns about the implications for the internal Israeli situation, suggesting that the targeting of Israeli leaders could become a reality.
This reflects a shift towards reciprocal actions. The Israeli military and regime have long believed that they could conduct successful security operations beyond their borders, a notion rooted in historical events dating back to the 1970s. Notable incidents include the assassinations of key figures, like when Ehud Barak came in power and assassination operation of Verdun happened. They simply assassinated Abu Hassan Saleh and the killing of Qassam Kafarnani from Palestine Liberation Organization, along with other operations such as Entebbe raid in Tunisia. However, this trajectory is now turned against them, as Israeli officials find themselves threatened by their resistance axis. This situation carries significant psychological implications. If the prime minister is in hiding, it raises questions about the safety of lower-ranking officials in Israel. This marks a genuine achievement for the resistance and a notable failure to the Israelis, as they face a significant security challenge and acknowledge their vulnerability to this opposing force.
And we see, Mr. Aboud, that they have resorted to escalating their attacks and intensifying their airstrikes in southern Lebanon, particularly in the southern suburbs of Beirut and also in the Bekaa Valley, where the frequency of the strikes has increased.
This is what the Israeli forces are capable of, and they succeed in taking revenge on civilians, whether in Gaza or Lebanon. The failure to achieve political goals and the inability to stop rocket and drone launches from Lebanon have led the Israelis to retaliate in such a brutal manner, systematically destroying residential areas in Lebanon to pressure the resistance movement and seek revenge for their unfulfilled objectives. This is not combat. It is murder and destruction. A respectable army that honors the principles of warfare engages directly with its opponent and does not target civilians. For instance, during the ongoing conflict between Ukraine and Russia, universities and schools remain open, and public transportation and internet services continue to function. The Russian army has not resorted to such brutality in their fighting. In contrast, the Israelis, supported by the Americans, engage in systematic destruction, killing anyone who stands in this way, whether they're civilians or military personnel.
Let's keep the focus on the Hezbollah drones and the general anxiety within Israel, as Hebrew media has reported the failure of anti-missile systems to intercept them, leading to a state of insecurity among the Israeli population. Mr. Tariq Aboud, you discussed today the supposed prominent strategy that any army in the world should adopt. However, the Israeli occupation forces resorting to targeting civilians highlights the extent of failure in intercepting drones, which has led to a decline in the confidence of Israelis in their military. This situation does not provide the security they seek in this conflict.
We are observing this in Israeli press and in statements from settlers as well. Trust has diminished because the situation has dragged on for a long time. Israelis are used to very short wars, even if they're internal conflicts. For instance, the 2006 war lasted 33 days, which Israelis considered one of the longest. Now the situation has extended beyond a year and a month, leading to a sense of instability. When settlers feel unsafe and targeted at any moment, it creates a significant reality for them.
The internal criticism directed at the Benjamin Netanyahu's administration and its handling of this aggressive war against Lebanon are therefore noteworthy.
The situation has been ugly for Israel since reaching its peak on September 27 and the assassination of the Secretary General Sayed Hassan Nasrallah. Netanyahu waged an all-out war on Lebanon, and now, with the ongoing war, the objectives are not being met and the high human cost is evident. If they acknowledge the losses incurred, the internal security and stability stretches from Tel Aviv to the northern settlements in Lebanon. This entire scenario suggests that Israeli settlers won't wait long for Netanyahu to tell them enough is enough. This conflict is turning into a war without clear strategic goals. The central question that arose in Gaza and now in Lebanon is about what comes next. Neither Netanyahu nor the military political leadership in Israel has provided an answer, and this dilemma will be even more complex in the northern front.
Mr. Tariq Aboud, the question remains regarding the precarious existence of the Zionists due to the ongoing aggressive war against Lebanon and the failure to restore security in the north. This raises concerns about Benjamin Netanyahu's promises to the settlers that this war would enable the return to settlements in northern Palestine.
The core of the issue was his desire to return the settlers back to the north, with the stated goal of the war being their return. He mentioned that troops have been dispatched to the north and the process of bringing the settlers back has started. Today, settlers have reached areas as far as Haifa and its surroundings, as well as parts of Tel Aviv envelope, where they're facing stability and the need for shelters. Additionally, many of the northern settlements, which had some settlers and residents, have been emptied. This situation is also prompting Netanyahu to shift his objectives. At the war's outset, he expressed his wish to return the settlers, but now he aims to change the West Asia, a sentiment he has reiterated on multiple occasions. Thus, the smaller goal of returning the settlers has deeper implications, as the number of displaced settlers across occupied Palestine has increased. This reflects a significant failure on the internal front, which is not being openly acknowledged at the moment. But in the coming days, Netanyahu may face serious repercussions regarding this matter.
Academic and political researcher Mr. Tariq Aboud, thank you for joining us in Israel Watch. Best regards until we meet again, God willing.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to another episode of the program Viewpoints. I am Atal, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers, Sheikh Rouhani and
Brother Muhammad.
Assalamu alaikum, Brother Muhammad. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So for today's episode, we want to talk about Al-Aqsa flood or operation. Let's talk a little bit about the background first and the history. So brother, when did it exactly start and why?
Now, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, Al-Aqsa flood operation is not something new that the Palestinian resistance had began or were operated. You see, the Palestinians for more than 70 years, seven decades, have been under oppression, have been under intense scrutiny from the Israeli occupation there. Yes. And so therefore, as the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran rightfully said in the recent Friday prayers, that the Palestinians have every legality for any form of resistance. And this is not only the stance of Iran. China have mentioned this in many of their occasions. Mm-hmm. And in the United Nations, this has been decided and it has been concluded that the Palestinian resistance should not be seen as terrorist organizations, even though other powers are seeing them to be as such actors. Yeah. And so therefore, this act of resistance was not something new. Mm-hmm. And although it was unexpected, but it was not something new.
That's right.
The background.
And in Islam, we have always been advised to have resistance, muqawamah,
exactly,
in a defensive format.
Exactly.
So it was not an aggressive attack, rather a defensive one.
Yes.
First, let's.
So, to consider this as defensive, we need to take in the context of what happened previously.
Yeah. Over a century.
Exactly. And what was going to happen. You see, after the re-election of Benjamin Netanyahu and the extreme right. Setanyahu, you could rather say.
Yeah.
The extreme right party in Israel, they were now taking power and they were now preparing the grounds to annex both the West Bank and Gaza with their expansionist overview.
Right.
And they were doing that practically, not necessarily mentioning in the news, not necessarily concluding it or even bringing it out in publications. But it was very well known in West Bank, which they have more power. Since the Palestinian Authority is a little more lenient with them, they were already encroaching.
Yes.
Many of the illegal settlers have made their settlements there and have encroached in the ground and so on.
Oh, right.
And this was about to happen for Gaza.
Yes.
And this was already decided. Since this was decided and it was known for those, the Palestinians in Gaza, especially Hamas, that this was going to happen, they had to take a preemptive attempt.
Mm-hmm.
As Yahya Sinwar recently said, well, he said it before as well, but they were not going to remain silent when they're attacked. Mm-hmm. They had to do something.
Right.
And they had prepared the grounds for the attack on Gaza, to be honest, because if you see the latest UN General Assembly debate that Netanyahu had presented, the agreement that they want, the normalization deal that they wanted to go with Saudi Arabia, that was the final stepstone, that was the final milestone that they wanted to meet to silence all the Arabs.
Oh, well. Okay.
And now when the grounds are ready, when this deal was finished, they would have encroached and annexed Gaza.
So you mean before 7th of October, Israel's were really decisive in attacking the Gaza,
of course,
full-scale for conflict. That's
They never mentioned in their state media, but meetings, their social media, their public opinion was that, look, Gaza is ours.
Right.
Remember, their expansion of states from river to the sea. Yes. They always wanted more.
The greater Israel.
Even the Sinai Desert, which is now under the Egyptian authority.
Yeah.
Even they want that. They wanted, of course, an expansion of state. If you look at the map, it's broad. So these are just steps they're taking, very cunning steps to annex it. Now, 7th of October was a very brave and a very strong deterrence against this expansionism.
Yes, that's right.
And this was like essentially a grave that Hamas dug for Israelis.
Mm-hmm.
And it's now ready. The Israelis, all their plans were now annihilated because it was very premature for them to now go and attack Gaza.
Thanks. And why Sheikh Rouhani is been changed from an attack into a genocide and a massacre now? I mean, this is a really a big question, okay? The conflicts between the two, I mean, the occupier Israelis and the occupied Palestine, there's not to be such scale, full-scale conflict between the two, okay? But this time, this has been changed into a kind of, I don't know, maybe a genocide, we can call it, ethnic cleansing, some call it, a massacre. Why?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You see that if we go back to the history of Judaism, we see that in many centuries back, I want to mention this fact that historically talking, in different periods of the time, in different periods of the history, we see that the Jewish people or the Jews actually had lots of problems with different nations,
right,
with different people.
With themselves too.
With themselves as well.
Okay.
That's why the history of Judaism is always problematic.
All right.
It is not only for nowadays that they have this problem with Palestinians or with Arabs. But in the history, if you go back to the history and you study the history of Judaism, you see that the problem were to the extent that sometimes some other kings, like Persia kings or sometimes the Eastern, Western kings, rescued them and saved them from the people,
right,
from the people who wanted to fight against them because of their ideas, their ideologies, their beliefs. And unfortunately, these kind of beliefs are still there. Some part of these people or groups of these people, they have these ideas that, okay, for example, all these Arab lands, I don't know, it's Muslims' land, these different territories belong to us and we have to conquer and we have to get control of them. So this is...
They're looking for the greater map.
Yeah, yeah.
Of
this
Israel,
is this is the idea that some of these extremist Jews, we can say, they have.
All right.
So this it is the main cause of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
All right.
Up to the time they do not change this mentality, this mindset.
All right.
Then of course, not only Arabs, wherever they are, whenever they are, they have problems, as they have in their history, and that is why I think when they, for example, kill the innocent of civilians. Innocent civilians of Palestine or Lebanon or Syria, for example, is not something new.
Sorry, theologically speaking, is there must be blood for, I mean, the growth of these tree of the greater? Is it really in the idea that if you shed more blood, you'll
be
more
successful? There are certain beliefs in their, we can say, religious scriptures,
okay,
and the Old Testament. Old Testament.
You mean the story?
Torah, Torah. Okay, if you refer to Torah and study, you see that there are certain kind of beliefs that that we are the best people.
All right.
We are the owner. We are the ruler. The
master of the world.
The master of the world, and the others are like sheep, and we are. So that's why we have a right to make use of these people.
Wow.
This is one of the ideas that they have. I think this kind of beliefs, this kind of ideology is always dangerous, not only for the Jews themselves, for the others as well. So if they do not change this mindset or this, what we can say, ideology, then of course this problem will continue.
All right.
And we would have the same problems with these people. Wherever they want to go, they would have the same problem. It's not only for the Arabs. For example, if they live in southern part of America, where no Muslims are there, if they live there, again, they have this ideology that we are the masters and we can make use of the properties, the everything that they have, and we can usurp, we can kill them, we can get the control, we can conquer their territory. So whenever you have this idea, then, of course, everybody would have problem with you. As in the history of Judaism, always they have problems with different nations, different people. So that is why it is not something very much new that we say, okay, well, now they have this problem with the people of Gaza or Lebanon. They would have this problem with everyone.
All right. But this time the Islamic Resistance group, Hamas, you know.
One point I wanted to mention is that we see that Europeans decided to locate them in the Middle East. Not in Europe.
Yeah. Because, as a puppet, man.
Because they knew better, them, that if they remain, if you give them a country in Europe, of course, then the problems will start with the Europeans.
They are now in kid of the school,
Of course, with Christians, they have more problems with rather than Muslims, because the one who was crucified by these Jews, we know that what happened to Jesus Christ. They cannot live peacefully with the others.
What I mentioned
was a kind of historical, theological fact.
This is the funny part of the history that, for example, Germany at the time of Hitler and Nazis killed more Jews
any time of the history possible, but nowadays they're friends. Yeah. Okay.
That's the irony of the history.
Yeah, the irony of history. That's right. This time Hamas, Hezbollah, you know, missed many of their great men.
Yeah.
And this time is very much different. Sinwar, Ismail Haniyeh, you know, Sayyid Saifuddin, Nasrullah, you know, said Nasrullah, all of them, you know, martyred. I mean, is it going to live more? I mean, with all these catastrophes, with all these losses that they made, are they going to continue their path or not? Is this possible?
One thing we need to acknowledge is that in war, it's war.
Yeah.
It's killing. It's bullets. It's blood. So in both sides, they are mourning. The Israelis are mourning. They're great men being killed in the front lines. Likewise, we are mourning in the resistance side with our great men slaughtered and killed and martyred in a very brutal and barbaric manner.
Yes.
So that's war. That's the reality of war.
Of course, the latest footage of Yahya Sinwar was really heroic.
That's the difference between us and them. That's the difference between us and them. They are armed to their teeth.
Yeah.
They're armed to their hair. They're armed to their nail tips. But we are armed with a stick and we still resist to the end. That's the difference. That's why in the Battle of Badr, when we won, the Islamic army won against the Kuffar. The Kuffar came to revenge in Uhud.
Right.
And Uhud, the war that was victorious, the Muslims lost because of their own actions, because of the hypocrites within the Muslims.
Right.
When this happened and the Prophet was extremely injured, the Kuffar came and they declared their victory and said, Muhammad, the death of today is equivalent to the death of Badr. All
right.
This kind of levels the ground.
Okay.
The Prophet sent a messenger and said, tell them that your deaths are in hell.
Yeah.
Our deaths are in heaven.
Yes.
So the difference between us and them is vast. It's not about us looking at the ones who are dead, their body on the ground, the mutilation and so on, but rather we look at the entire context, the entire scenario.
And I think they made a great mistake by filming the last scenes of the life of Yahya Sinwar, you know?
Yes, of course.
With the helicam, you know, they thought that, okay, this would be a great
even they acknowledged
triumph and overcome for us. But, you know, even AI, when you give it and say, okay, picture for us the bravery of Yahya Sinwar, so all the Marvel Studios superheroes are bowing down to this man.
That's
even
true.
AI knew that.
So but the Israel, deaths, the right. deaths on our side, yes, of course, it's very unfortunate, and it's something that it puts us in the state of mourning.
Mm-hmm.
But our state of mourning is a state of mourning of Lady Zainab.
All right.
When she saw her brother mutilated, her entire family mutilated, she did not leave. She did not become hopeless. She did not say, "Oh, that's it, the end of Islam." She took the flag and the banner and continued with it. That's how the resistance is based in. Exactly.
I saw nothing but beauty. That's right.
Exactly. That's what resistance is based upon. So when we see the martyrdom of people, when one blood spills on the ground, we consider that as the emergence of hundreds of thousands of Yahya Sinwar. When we see the blood of Shaheed Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah spill on the ground, we see hundreds of thousands of Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah taking that place and position to continue that resistance.
And this is not something new, because during all these years, just look at the names, Abdullah Al-Musawi, for example, Sheikh Raghab Harb, you know, Ahmad Yasin, Ali Yasin, and all these great men, okay? So were martyred, and again, they were replaced. I mean, these organizations are not working like the Western one, okay?
No.
Because faith is at work over here.
Exactly.
This is not the money. This is not the mafia type of movie that we are.
Exactly. Yes, for a small period of time, there is going to be a lot of problems and conflicts and a little bit of hopelessness.
Yes.
But of course, ultimately, as Allah has promised, فَإِنَّ حِزْبَ اللَّهِ هُمُ الْغَالِبُونَ The party of Allah, the one who is aligned with the values that Allah has instilled as good values, is the party that will win and it will take over.
All right. Thank you very much for your presence, and thank you very much, dear listeners, for being with us in the program Viewpoints. For more information, visit our website at iranradio.ir. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah. Free Palestine.
Every day we tell each other that this day will be the last. And tomorrow we all can go home free, and all this will finally end. Palestine, tomorrow will be free. Palestine.
beloved, and you, dear friend. But I have you, my dear. May God protect you, my dear. May God protect you.
IRIB English Radio. For those who seek the truth.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are
a Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special, and I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRAB English Radio. Welcome back to a new episode of your very favorite Muslim lady. Well, I'm so happy to be here. Actually, I'm Asma, and it's very much amazing to be here with Sister Zainab again. Assalamu alaikum, sister, and welcome.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
And thank you very much for being here. Introduce yourself very much briefly for those who have just joined us and they do not know about you.
All right. Well, this is Zainab Askari. I'm from Kashmir. That's under the administration of India. And I have been living in Iran for some 9 years now. And I have been studying Hausa for the last 8 years. During this Hausa time, I have had extensive research in the field of I would say family, the strengthening of family, writing a book over women in the perspective of Islam.
So thank you for being here, sister. Today's episode is devoted on mothering and on mothers. Well, the word mother has got many connotations to itself, like mothers are brave, mothers are kind, mothers are the engine of the family, and mothers are the source of kindness in the house, and they're the ones who actually nurture soldiers, they nurture mothers, they nurture girls like them to be brave and to be passionate, to share kindness and not to let this tree of kindness to fade away and to actually be dried. So speaking of mothers would be pretty easy, because you're going to have a lot of words to describe their kindness and the essence of motherhood. But then being a mother is very difficult. She was once a girl at a house who was treated like a princess, and everything she wished for was just ready for her. With a ton of difference in different families. But anyway, girls and the daughters of all the houses are respected to their parents. But then there is something. Now she's the wife of a man. She enters a house, and after a while she would have a baby. She's going to change her entire routine of lifestyle. And then everything would be so different for her. Her comfort, her peace, and the time she devotes for Allah even is going to differ. Right now, she wouldn't have much of free time for her own self. Like, she's going to be so busy. And this is very difficult. How can I moderate my responsibilities as a mother with the worship and responsibilities that I have towards myself?
That is tangible to all mothers out there.
Exactly.
When you're a mother, you have so many responsibilities on your shoulders now. And when you give your 100% as well, still you are tired somewhere within your, inside.
Mm-hmm.
And you feel like the way I used to kind of do worship before, it's not like that anymore. Because the moment I want to, pray my salat, and I have this tension in my mind that my child may be crying, or I have to finish it soon, or I have to reach back to my children, or I have to make things for my children, even if they're grown up.
And even if they grow up, then you would have so much of worries and, anxiousness about their future.
Yeah. So there's this, there are certain things that we will discuss today that will give energy to these moms to be acting more, you know, with energy. So there was this woman who came to Imam Khomeini rahmatullahi alayhi and said that it's been a few years that since I'm a mother, I don't feel that much, you know, attentive in the worship. This worship does not really touch my heart, actually, because before I was a mother, I used to be like, my worship would touch my heart, and then I would
Because you had more of time, right, and you had right. more of free
and
now, space
since
for
I'm
yourself.
A mother of like two, since these 2 years, and this has become like really very hard, like, what should I do? My mom says to her that you give me your 2 years of motherhood and I give my entire marjayat to you.
Oh, wow.
So it's like, hey, a mother should know the rewards of being a mother. And from the same Imam, like Imam Khomeini rahmatullahi alayhi, he has a lot of things in Sahih Imam about mothers. He says the first school that has children is the mother's lap.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so like, your lap is a school now.
Yeah, you
and
become
you
the teacher.
Nurture, you can nurture a mm-hmm. child beyond the, you know, what you expect, like your role is like limited. No, it is not. And then he says that a mother's service to society is greater than a teacher's service.
Mm-hmm.
And it is greater than everyone's service. So just imagine the role of a mother here. Hey again, he says that motherhood is the occupation of the prophets.
Yeah.
Just as the prophets came to train people, your job is to train your children.
Wow, that's very deep and full of, you know, attention and affection towards women. And it shows how important and worthy and valuable is the role of a mother in the family and, of course, in society. She's as if she's being a soldier, an important person doing an important, actually, mission. But nobody looks at it from that perspective in everyday life. Mothers, they all are familiar with sensitive words that would touch your heart, and they all could teach you stuff you could never been able to imagine if it wasn't about them. So, dear ladies, you're listening to your own program. In here, we are talking about the essence of Muslim ladies, actually, where we come from, the lap of our mothers. So we're talking about motherhood and how valuable it is.
Imam Khomeini rahmatullah again says in Sahih Imam, he says that the role of a woman in society is higher than the role of men, because of women, in addition to being an active group in all dimensions themselves, they train active groups in their labs. So that's another thing, like, you're not just training, you're not just yourself active, but you're training someone for tomorrow to be the active in the society, right?
Exactly.
So what a person hears or sees from his mother as a child, it leaves a mark in his heart and stays with him until the end. Mothers should pay attention to this.
Exactly. Of course, what you mentioned reminds me of all these psychological and psychoanalytical notions related to human psyche that actually refer to a certain time of childhood in which mother has got a great role to play. Like, all the problems that are going to surge up and all the good qualities that you're going to have are rooted in your childhood, where you had no one but your parents by your side. So the role of a mother and father are so important in a child's development, but more specifically, mothers, because they are these creatures who spend much more of time with their children, and they're those who care more, and they spend much more of quality time with their children.
Yeah, and also, you know, it reminds me again of that hadith, Prophet Muhammad, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon him and his purified family, he said, He was asked, like, whom should I pray respectfully?
Exactly.
And he says, to your mother, and then to your mother, and then to your mother, and then to your father. So
after three times of question, he finally mentions the father.
Father,
so
yeah. Mother definitely has got that, her own particular place.
Exactly.
Did you hear a child, a baby, infant, like, crying, and then when he gets into the lap of a mother, he kind of gets that comfort and starts
exactly.
getting silenced?
Mm-hmm.
It was
the source of pleasure and happiness for the
yeah.
child when he's a kid. Is the mother's lap, for sure.
I was researched about it, basically. Why is it actually the lap of mother when he does not even recognize anyone else? Why is it like the lap of mother so, so comfortable to this child? I was said that since the child is in the womb of a mother for like 9 months, so he recognizes the heartbeat
exactly,
of his mother.
Yeah.
So that's why this child kind of finds that solace and comfort
mm-hmm.
in her lap. So,
because the sound of the heartbeat seems as a music that is so peaceful.
For, like,
yeah.
He's been hearing for those 9 months.
And that's why it's peaceful for the children, for the kids, for
yeah,
the infants.
Because it's a blank slate
mm-hmm.
still. It's not, it has neither become, you can make it gray, black, I don't know, darker, or keep it white. But it's like very hard to keep it that plain. But since at that phase of their life, it's very, very plain. It's very, very black. They have been hearing this for
mm-hmm.
like 9 months. So they find that solace and comfort in your lap. So, dear ladies, you can bring up children who can protect the ambitions of prophets.
So see how worthy is your position and situation in life. Being a mother is pretty much more respectful.
Because Imam Khomeini, he again says that, he says that they betrayed our society by degrading motherhood in the eyes of the mothers. While the best job in the world is motherhood and upbringing children, all the achievements of our country are provided by you, the mothers, and they didn't want it to happen.
Yeah, okay. And another factor I would bring it up right in here would be the materialistic perspective that the today's world is just inculcating on the minds of women. Like, your achievements must be something tangible, like your bank account, like how much money you can afford, and how much income you have, and all of these materialistic stuff that does not really matter in the hereafter. I'm
right.
not saying that trying so hard for your life is not an important or valuable thing. No. I'm just saying that today's world has changed many things in the eyes of women and men. But in the case of women, today's world has actually forced them, has forced the women to think that if you're a mother and you're not making money, then it's as if you're doing nothing in your life. If you're a mother and you do not know, I don't know, certain specific skills, then you are not actually a valuable person. This is unfortunately the picture and image that today's world has forced on the eyes of all the inhabitants of the earth. But this shouldn't be like this.
Yeah,
there must be a
like,
change.
Of course, like when the motherhood was degraded in the eyes of mother herself, so then definitely this thing will
mm-hmm.
happen. But these mothers have to be reminded that it was these mothers that, you know, personalities like Malika Ashtar were born. It was these mothers, it was from the lap of these mothers that Hossein ibn Ali alayhi salam was born.
Exactly.
It was from the lap of these mothers, like all those great personalities were born
mm-hmm.
who can save a nation.
So today's episode was just a reminder to revive this valuable and worthy and very important a responsibility and concept of motherhood into the at least eyes of the women themselves, because if they recognize and acknowledge their own responsibilities as mothers and their own value, then nobody else is going to give it to them. So love you all the mothers out there, and thank you for being such kind source of love and affection in all the families, in all the households. So this was all for today's episode. I hope you just enjoyed it. Until another session, bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Who is the love one?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illa The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity. Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah, Muhammad is the messenger, to Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men, and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson. This is Palestine Declassified. We're the only show that's dedicated to investigating and exposing the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. In today's show, we'll be talking to the Electronic Intifada's Associate Editor, Asa Wynne-Stanley, about the impact of the British government misusing anti-terrorist legislation against journalists. His home was raided by counter-terrorism police last month. In our first report, Latif Abouchakra takes up the story about what happened to Asa in the early hours of the morning on the 17th of October.
Asa Wynne-Stanley is a Welsh journalist working in London for the well-known independent media website Electronic Intifada. He is the latest casualty of the war declared by the British state on anti-Zionism. On Thursday, 17th of October, he was awoken at 5:40 a.m. by around 10 counter-terrorism police. They did not arrest him, but seized several electronic devices. Wynne-Stanley takes up the story in an interview given the next day.
20 to 6 yesterday morning, police came, counter-terror command came. There was about 10 of them. And they basically barged into the house. You know, they were ringing on the doorbell. It was quite terrifying. And they, they were here for about 3 hours. And they took away all of my devices that I use for my work as a journalist. And they made it very clear that they knew what my profession was. They knew who I was. And this was in regards to social media posts that I'd made. They didn't specify which ones. They didn't arrest me, thankfully.
A letter addressed to Wynne-Stanley from the Counter-Terrorism Command of the Metropolitan Police Service indicates that the authorities are aware of your profession as a journalist, but that, notwithstanding, police are investigating possible offences under Section 1 and 2 of the Terrorism Act 2006. These provisions set out the purported offence of encouragement of terrorism, but it's worth looking at the Act to see what it actually says. This section applies to direct or indirect encouragement to the commission, preparation, or instigation of acts of terrorism. But Section 2 is a caveat that the person must intend others to be encouraged to commit terrorism offences or be reckless about that. But of course, neither Hamas or any of the other Palestinian resistance factions, only three of which are proscribed in the UK, operate in the UK. And nobody really imagines that Wynne-Stanley or others are calling for people to take up arms in the UK. which is what appears to be envisaged by the law. This suggests that just like the other recent cases, this is likely to be an attempt to intimidate caused by the heavy pressure being put on the police by the Zionist movement, and indeed, sections of the political class. What's clear here is that this is a further escalation. The police quoted Section 12 of the Terrorism Act against both Sarah Wilkinson and Richard Medhurst, but not the 2006 Act. And when Stanley is the first professional journalist who has had his home address raided. When Stanley's interview the morning after the police raid to the independent journalist Crispin Flintoff reflected on the timing and significance of the raid.
It just seems like nothing but a harassment and a way to stop journalists who are reporting on what is the Holocaust of our times, what is the genocide of the Israelis in the Gaza Strip. There's like 200,000 people that have been killed so far, you know. On Monday, we saw those horrific scenes of this young man being burned alive in the Gaza Strip. You know, we all saw it. We wake up every morning to new crimes and new reports of babies being killed and men, women and children just being annihilated in the Gaza Strip and now Lebanon as well. And the British authorities, instead of doing anything against that, are still carrying on in their involvement with it.
Joining me in the studio as usual is our resident expert, David Miller, who's widely regarded as the UK's preeminent scholarly critic of Israel. David's a senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul's AIM University, and he's a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch. And as I said in the introduction, our guest contributor today is Asa Wynne-Stanley, who, as well as being the associate editor with the Electronic Intifada, is also an acclaimed investigative journalist and author. He publishes a weekly Substack newsletter called Palestine Still the Issue and hosts the Electronic Intifada podcast. His book, Weaponizing Anti-Semitism, is a must-read explanation about the way the Israel lobby sabotaged Jeremy Corbyn's leadership of the British Labour Party. Welcome to the show. Asa, what's the latest with your case?
Well, the latest is my legal team is making very strong representations to the police, and essentially we are waiting to hear back about those. They have... I can't say too much about the detail of it, but what I can say is that we are taking very, very strong action to protect my sources. We're going all out to protect my sources. Obviously, you know, the devices that they took were, they contained some documentation related to my journalism. They contained, obviously my phone has contacts of people that I talk to, people that I email, and similarly my computer and whatnot. So it potentially contains information that could identify sources, could identify personal information about sources in a context of where I've reported on groups like Palestine Action, for example, and people in Palestine as well, Palestinians themselves in Palestine. Yes. It could be in we know that the British state works very closely with the Israeli security state. Yeah. So, in the case of Palestinians that we work with as part of the Electronic Intifada, potentially compromising them as sources could actually endanger their lives and or their livelihoods and whatnot. Yes. as could potentially be the case for people like Palestine Action activists in this country. Yes. Yes. So my legal team is extremely aware of the importance of this issue and are doing everything possible to stop the police from actually accessing any of my devices.
Right, okay. Well, David, just explain, will you, the sections of the Terrorism Act that the police quoted at Asa when they raided his home?
So the act that's been used against Richard Medhurst, Sarah Wilkinson, is the 2000 Terrorism Act. This is the 2006 Terrorism Act. They have to keep revising the Terrorism Act because they have to keep extending their powers because they haven't got enough powers, apparently. The Section 1.2 of the 2006 Act, which is what was used against Asa for the first time, talks about encouraging terrorism, but you have to have intended to have encouraged the terrorism. So it's kind of like they're assuming that there are people in the security establishment who think that ISIS is setting up some kind of version of the Qassam brigades. Yes. in the UK, which of course is plainly ridiculous. And so it's obvious that this is an attempt to harass him and to harass other journalists as part of the intimidation effect. You know, well, people think, oh, if they've come for Asa, they've come for Richard, they've come for Sarah, they might come for me next. I might not do anything. I might not say the things I've been saying. I might not report in the way I've been reporting. So it's obviously an intimidation tactic. But that's what the legislation suggests. But given what Asa's just said about the collaboration there is between the British security state and the Israeli security state, and of course the fact that the British have been allowing conducting intelligence operations for the Israelis, you might sort of think that this kind of act is something which could actually apply to the activities of the police themselves, because if they're actually helping to set people up for killings, these are, you know, potentially describable, indeed, even in the way in which the act is drafted, as acts of terrorism. Sure. So, you know, we're in the kind of looking glass here, aren't we? Indeed. Where the very opposite of what's being said is the case.
Right, yes. Well, Asa, what do you make of the legal basis for this action then? I mean, obviously, you're not calling for an armed insurgency in the UK on behalf of the Palestinian resistance, are you?
No, it's ludicrous. I mean, it's... And there was no question of that when the police were here, right? There was no... It wasn't even in question. Like, they were very, very clear in the paperwork, as you mentioned in the package. Yeah. We're aware of your profession. And they also said actually something quite interesting, which was they're aware of the fact that I'm involved in the undercover policing inquiry, which, you know, when I was an activist in International Solidarity Movement London, nearly 20 years ago, going back now, there was an undercover spy. There was an undercover police spy in that group, as there were in many groups, more than 1,000 groups going back to the 1960s. And so, you know, they claim to have that it's okay that they're still investigating me as a journalist. So it seems to me that, like David mentioned, that this is an attempt to expand their powers as they've been doing through law, and expand their powers precedent. Yeah. So, you know, it's the 2000 Act, and now the 2006 Act is being used, and it's being used against journalists more now. So, you know, this may, hopefully they will give my devices back. We'll be able to get my devices back. This could be the end for me, but I don't think it's going to be the, in terms of, you know, the end of their harassment against me. Hopefully that's the case, but we don't know.
But I don't think it's the
end of these powers.
No, absolutely. I mean, as I say, though, so the fact that they've had them and had access to them, you know, potentially could compromise, you know, your sources. It is very worrying. But David, I mean, Asa there was just alluding to, wasn't he, kind of the spy cop relations. We know that what state's been capable of over many, many years. But what we've been seeing of late, it really does represent a real escalation, doesn't it?
It's an escalation in relation to the genocide in Gaza, in relation to the question of Palestine overall. It's an escalation in comparison to, for example, the conflict in the north of Ireland, where the terrorism legislation was used against journalists, but not in the way it's now being used against journalists in this particular case. So it absolutely is an escalation. But also, let's remember, it's an escalation in the context of a new government. And this is a new government which is showing that it's even more escalatory in these matters than the Conservatives were, and the Conservative government was a government of real extremists.
Of course, yeah. Well, Asa, very briefly, because we're going to go to our next package now, but did the police take all of the devices in your house, including those of family members?
No, they didn't. They didn't take devices that didn't belong to me, but there was a kind of pressure tactic where they implied they may do that if I hadn't had cooperated with them to the limited extent that I did. One of the first things they asked me was to identify the devices in the house that may contain excluded materials that's subject to journalistic or protections or legal privileges. Of course, they were trying to portray that as something that was to protect me, but I was very, you know, mindful of identifying devices that couldn't contain information